Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
To me, these more universal themes, such as rebirth and redemption and a kind of moral accounting by which we don't condemn each other, but we try to create conditions in which we can come back together to take the brokenness that is inevitably part of human society and try to create conditions for a wholeness, a coming back together. That, to me, is what religion is about.
That's the voice of author and professor Robert Jensen. On this week's show, we speak to Dr. Jensen about the need to have uncomfortable conversations if we are to create a more just society. So stay tuned.
I'm very privileged this morning. My guest is Dr. Robert Jensen. He's the author of many books. His latest book coming out very soon is Arguing for Our Lives, Critical Thinking in Crisis Times. Very privileged to have you on our program. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, good to be with you.
Your book is about to come out, and I think that there couldn't be a better time to start thinking about what it means to argue critically in our society where politics, by all intents and purposes, has been declared as something that we don't want to engage, that it's dichotomized or is an either-or situation. So what are you inviting us to do in this book?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to think about the very terms that we're using differently. So argument, for instance, if you ask most people, do you like to argue, they'll think of arguing as sort of name-calling, shouting, not a reasoned and thoughtful process, but a kind of combative process. And, of course, if you look around at the places where people see arguments, let's say mass media, you know, especially the cable TV news channels, or in the political arena of electoral politics, in fact, that's what people do see, mostly combative and angry kinds of arguing. But in the classical sense, argumentation is about using our rational faculties and taking account of our own emotional lives and trying to come to judgment collectively by challenging each other, yes, and sometimes challenging each other can be tense, but it's aimed at producing the best argument, not simply at winning. And so I think what I'm asking, and this is what a lot of people who teach, you know, in critical thinking or in public address or in rhetoric have been trying to ask for a long time, is that more thoughtful collective process. And that means not just bumping into people you agree with, but also not only being willing to talk to, but sometimes seeking out conversations with people you disagree with. And the book is aimed at making that attractive, because as you point out, to a lot of people it seems scary or alienating, not attractive.
Now, when we look at the way the media and in many ways our school systems construct our society, we seem to have recurrent scripts that come out. We're either painted, I'm talking about we, this people, society, citizens, however we want to describe ourselves, are either painted as consumers, you know, who are illogical, irrational, and sometimes selfish, you know, as we see in the images of Black Friday. But we never speak about how this structure in which we participate, it's already been pre-constructed, you know what I mean, where people are dialogically being created into this, you know, illogical consumers, without looking at the economical, social impediments that people have to face. How would this enable us to have a deeper discussion as to how else we can describe, yeah, imagine ourselves?
Well, first of all, when contemporary consumer capitalism tells us that we're greedy and self-interested, we should recognize that, of course, there's some truth in that. Every human being on the planet is capable of acting in a greedy and self-interested way. The point is, we're more than that. And so one challenge to the dominant culture is not to deny that we are imperfect beings, but to recognize that. On the count of being illogical, irrational, emotional beings, that's obviously true. You, me, every other human being is also, I think, mostly illogical, irrational, and emotional. That's the nature of being human. But we also, of course, have this capacity for rational thought and for collective engagement. So it's not that what the dominant culture tells us about ourselves is completely wrong. It's just that it's incomplete and insufficient. So I think this project of enhancing our capacity for critical thinking is about taking that rational faculty, the capacity for, you know, stepping back and in a fairly logical and rational process trying to understand the world, and recognizing that it goes on in the context of our emotional lives, and not trying to keep the two separate, but trying to bring the two together. And I think when we do that, not surprisingly, when we use our intellectual abilities in conjunction with our emotional intelligence, what we realize is the dominant culture doesn't have much to offer. You mentioned Black Friday in the United States, this obsession with the low-cost bargains of the day and the pre-Christmas shopping frenzy. Well, if you step back and take a look at that, it's crazy. It's insane. No decent human being would want to rush the doors of a store to participate in such an enterprise. And the reason we can come to that conclusion is not purely rational. It's also emotional. It's recognizing that as people, we want to be more than just money-grubbing bargain hunters. And it's recognizing, as you point out then, that we aren't money-grubbing bargain hunters by nature alone. It's because that's the way the system constructs us. And so, you know, this recognition in contemporary psychology and neuroscience that, you know, we don't really make decisions purely rationally, that's an important recognition, but it doesn't condemn us to being crazy. In fact, it's how we come to act, I think, more sensibly.
I would argue that for a long time we've been, at least in the Western tradition, we've been operating from our heads, particularly in the academy, and we are invited to distance ourselves from what we feel, from, you know, to almost deny an expression of our emotions. To me, there's this schizophrenic relationship that we've engaged in, where we know in our gut that, you know, to maintain the capitalist systems, for instance, it's irrational in the sense that it hurts a lot of people. It's a system that it's already been many times had to be rescued and put on life support by different kinds of measures. And yet we are told that, you know, rationally or, you know, from the brain, this is the one that makes the most sense, simply because we don't know what else is beyond capitalism. We don't know what else we could do if we were to, say, create something collectively, something that ensure collectivity rather than individualism. So looking at this critically, what prevents us then, you know, from creating or taking on this challenge of bringing to life a world that has been deadened by competition and capital concentration?
Well, I think part of what makes it difficult to see a future is because so much of our lives have been, you know, essentially defined by systems that failed. So you and I would agree, I think, that contemporary capitalism is a failed project. It's ecocidal. It's literally undermining the capacity of the planet to sustain life. It's created incredible wealth inequality that has destroyed any possibility of solidarity, of a kind of decent human community. On the other hand, some of the large-scale attempts to challenge capitalism, predominantly the so-called socialist or communist models that come out of the Soviet Union, were equally, if not greater, failures in all of these measures. And so people look around and they don't see a lot of options. And so I think the real challenge is to be honest with ourselves about how we failed and being willing to experiment and take chances and know that we may fail again. So for me, a lot of the important experimentation is going on at the grassroots level. I live here in Austin, Texas, and we have a number of projects trying to create, for instance, democratic workplaces, or challenge the most egregious abuses in conventional workplaces. All of those are attempts at building community and rebuilding that solidarity. And I think that's the important work. Now, the dominant culture, you know, doesn't have much left to offer, from my point of view, which is why it scrambles so hard to make sure that we don't have this kind of conversation. Let's just take, you know, you're talking again about shopping. It's hard not to think about shopping at this point of, you know, the season. Just think about the complete craziness of capitalism. On the one hand, economic theory tells us that capitalism works because we are rational actors, because we all evaluate our own desires, and then we go into the market and we try and meet those desires, and as long as we have information, the market will work. Well, that's the theory of capitalism. Well, the practice of capitalism, as we all know, is about trying to undermine people's ability to act rationally. It's called advertising. There's something like $400 billion a year spent in the United States, in fact, not to help people act rationally, but to undermine their ability to act rationally. Think about most advertising. It has nothing to do with information and rational processes. It's all about emotion and creating a certain kind of image and getting people to make economic decisions on what they're going to buy, not based on rationality, but based on the opposite. So the system itself is basically incoherent. And I think that's why when we critique it, the system reacts so harshly. I just wrote an essay about how this plays out in the curriculum at the University of Texas. And a lot of angry responses to what seemed to me to be kind of pretty basic critiques. And the more the system is incoherent, the more it's going to fight to make sure people don't understand that incoherence. So, you know, this is why I think this project of critical thinking is so crucial. And I want to make it clear, I don't mean critical thinking at some high-level esoteric, you know, plane that ordinary people can't do. I consider myself, even though I'm a professor, a pretty ordinary person. And the critical thinking I'm talking about is very basic like this. It's about helping people walk through the set of questions you're putting on the table today, for instance, and coming to judgment. And it's a judgment that we all have the capacity to make. And I think that's a lot of the work in front of us.
I think about, you know, the way we are faced with constant discourses about what our economy looks like, how our economy operates, and what you just described. In one way, we tend to be presented with a world that's already been predetermined, that unless we fall in line, you know, some of us will be exiled and some of us will be displaced. And so there becomes this kind of illogical process of doing what hurts us, of doing what we are not in favor of, and thereby perpetuating it. So I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the way we have shaped ourselves around relationships that perpetuate not just racism, but, you know, social inequality, religious biases that legitimize some acts of violence and obscure, opaque, and even deny the suffering of others.
You know, those of us who live in with some level of privilege, I happen to have quite a bit of it as a university professor in a job with, you know, a more than adequate salary and a lot of job protection. So I'm part of this, and I can't pretend otherwise. And it seems to me that a lot of people with that kind of privilege make one of two choices. One is to decide they're not going to critique the system because it's just too painful to always be critiquing a system that you're part of. And I see that. I see people just embracing the system and becoming its greatest proponents, even though at some level I think they see the basic points that we're talking about today. And I think that's a failure. That's a capitulation to the existing system of power, as you're pointing out. Other people become so angry that they can do nothing but denounce the system. And I see friends and colleagues who take that path, and I think that's also destructive because it doesn't create, open up, help define the possibilities. The fact is, I work at the University of Texas at Austin, which is a large university dedicated to making sure the existing power structure continues. We have a business school and an economics department and a government department, and they're all very conventional. At the same time, the University of Texas does create space for me to teach the way I teach, for others to really, in a very, very principled way, try to encourage students to engage in this critical thinking. And that's where I think the work is done, both within these institutions that do create some space for it, and as I said earlier, outside the institutions where people are experimenting with new ways. Well, out of that, we can hope that some sort of, you know, new vision of society emerges and people start finding the energy and the resources to try and make that vision real. But it's a mess. And I think, you know, that's partly what has people so dejected these days. The world is just a mess. There's really, I think, no reason to expect that some new system, you know, like socialism, is going to come and clean up all the problems. The human species is at a very difficult point in our history. We now can recognize that our intelligence, which is considerable, the intelligence that created the modern industrial world with all this energy we exploit, that intelligence is now threatening the viability of our continued existence on the planet. That's quite an interesting place to be in, to know that the skills that made it possible for us to reach a point where the human species dominates the planet, that those same skills may well destroy that planet. You know, these are the really tough questions we're facing, and I don't think human beings have ever faced this kind of question before. And so we all need to dig in wherever we are, whatever system we're part of, and start being willing to deal with questions at this level. And the questions are difficult, but there is also a kind of excitement, for me, an exhilaration in finally looking squarely at the problems we face and trying to be part of some sort of long-term solution. There's a lot of fear involved in that process, but there's also a lot of joy when you come together with people who are like-minded, who want to face those questions also.
Well, I acknowledge that the journey ahead of us is not an easy one. I feel that in Western society, we tend to take a lot of breaks and we tend to rest a lot, while in other places, and I'm thinking of Latin America, you know, where resistance to an inequality that is pervasive, that is destructive, has become part of our survival. You know, it's not a matter of if you'd like to or if you think it's possible. It's people make their path by walking, and in many mm-hmm. ways, I think that's what we have lost in this world. You know, we have been mystified and seduced by our objects and become subjects of those objects. You know what I mean? We've sure. stopped to have these difficult conversations of where is it that we're going? Who are we? Why are we static? Why have we stopped flowing?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And in that sense, probably the greatest threat to folks like me who are privileged is our own affluence. That is, it's so easy to insulate yourself from the painful reality that you're describing. As you point out, people in other parts of the world, or even people within the United States who don't share that privilege, there's not a choice. You don't wake up in the morning and ask yourself, am I going to face reality today? Because reality doesn't allow you to choose. And so that affluence and that privilege becomes an impediment to understanding. That's why I think when one of the most satisfying things I ever hear a student say is when a student comes into my office and says, after taking your class, I can't see the world in the same way anymore. Every day, students tell me, I feel at odds with the world. And I say, great, that means you've woken up to the reality of the world in which we live. Now, of course, one doesn't want to stay in a state of constant agitation and anger. You're pointing out that we also have to move into spaces where collectively we find ways to resist and to explore new ideas. And that's part of the task, is not only coming to judgment about the world, but then doing something. And that doing something doesn't just mean, you know, voting. It doesn't just mean joining a group. It means really struggling to create something new. And I think everywhere you go, you'll find people doing that. But it's usually under the radar. You have to seek it out. And that's what you're pointing out, is culture just makes it, in a sense, easy to avoid things. easy to ignore things, easy to just sort of be comfortable. And for those of us with that kind of privilege, that is the big struggle.
You wrote a book which I absolutely love, All My Bones Shake, Finding a Prophetic Voice. Can you talk a little bit about then, you know, because we every year we go through this process of at least a ritual process, a ritual, I suppose, of celebrating a rebirth. And whether you're Christian, pagan, or, you know, however you'd like to celebrate your spirituality, this is an event that shapes us and that informs at least how we behave for the month of December. So can we talk a little bit about the opportunities that come from engaging or at least envisioning a society where we are being judged on how we treat the least among of us, and that to me means those who are most vulnerable, and how do we find that connection with, you know, that spiritual connection that helps us break through all the other you know, structures of privilege and power?
I think that's important, and here, to me, the important thing isn't what religious or philosophical tradition one identifies with. I happen to come out of a Christian tradition, but I think the same fundamental question can and should be asked in every tradition, and that's not, you know, how do you label yourself as a believer, a non-believer, a member of this church or that church, but within that tradition you're part of, are you part of what we might call the royal perspective or the prophetic perspective? And here I'm borrowing from lots of good theology that points out that in any society there are people who take up what one thinker has called the royal position, that is, supportive of power, supportive of the court, the king, and whatever else we're calling the power of the day. And in every religion there's a royal tradition that supports power, but there's also a countervailing position, what's often called the prophetic position, which is calling out the powerful for their abuses. And it seems to me, as you're suggesting, that the more important tradition is the prophetic tradition, the ability to confront ourselves and each other with the ways we've failed. And within Christianity, within Islam, within Judaism, within any of the major religions, you'll find that prophetic tradition. And I think, you know, depending on the religion, at certain times of the year, we're called to remember that. You know, religious symbols can be taken in a dangerous direction, a direction that is about exclusiveness, about either you belong to my club or you're evil. But they also have a universal appeal, as you're pointing out, and redemption is one of those, rebirth, the notion that we all make mistakes, that in fact, human life is to some degree defined by mistakes, but we're not condemned to simply live with those mistakes, that there is a process of rebirth and redemption. And every decent society has to include some avenue for that, or else we would, you know, never get out of the failures that are inevitable. And so, you know, take the notion of Jubilee, for instance, a related kind of idea that as inequality mounts, there needs to be a period where we forgive debts, where we start anew, where we kind of clean the slate off and commit to that decent collective human condition. Well, you know, all of these are present in all of the great faith traditions, and I think it's important to mark them. Because if we don't, then the royal tradition, the use of religion, for instance, to support power is going to dominate. And so, even though I'm not a traditional believer, and in fact a lot of my Christian brothers and sisters would say I'm not a real Christian because I don't have a certain conception of God or Jesus, but what's more important to me than what I tend to call those supernatural claims about a God up in the sky or a Messiah figure who got up from the tomb, those are supernatural claims that I don't take very seriously, quite frankly. To me, these more universal themes, such as rebirth and redemption and a kind of moral accounting by which we don't condemn each other, but we try to create conditions in which we can come back together to take the brokenness that is inevitably part of human society and try to create conditions for a wholeness, a coming back together. That, to me, is what religion is about. And coming into the Christmas season in my tradition, it seems to me it's a great time to talk about those things.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is Dr. Robert Jensen. His latest book, Arguing for Our Lives, Critical Thinking in Crisis Times, is coming up soon. Thank you again for joining us. How can our audience access your writing?
Well, the easiest way is just to put my name into Google, Robert Jensen, and the first page that comes up will be mine, and there'll be links to a lot of not only the book coming out, but other articles people can take a look at.
Thank you again for being with us.
Great, thanks.
Take care. That was Dr. Robert Jensen. He is the author of many books. I highly recommend you check out his website. His latest book, Arguing for Our Lives, Critical Thinking in Crisis Times, will be coming in the spring of 2013.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.